A mesa desta manhã tem como tema processos de engajamento da comunidade e a convidada para ser a mediadora é a doutora Maria Gorete Maciel, a quem tenho a satisfação de pedir para que suba ao palco. Médica de família e comunidade, diretora de Serviço de Cuidados Paliativos do Hospital do Servidor Público Estadual de São Paulo, fundadora da Academia Nacional de Cuidados Paliativos, membro da Câmara Técnica de Terminalidade da Vida e Cuidados Paliativos do Conselho Federal de Medicina, Gorete é também diretora do Instituto Paliar. A dinâmica dessa sessão é igual à das sessões anteriores. Após a apresentação de cada um dos três palestrantes, teremos um momento cultural, em seguida, um intervalo, antes de retomarmos a fase de perguntas. Gorete, é com você.
Obrigada, Ana. Bom dia a todos e todas. Obrigada, Ana. Obrigada, Samir. Obrigada a toda a comunidade que compõe esse grande encontro de serviços de cuidados paliativos. Eu não posso me demorar, os palestrantes são os mais importantes aqui, mas eu fico muito honrada de moderar uma mesa com esse tema sobre engajamento da comunidade. Acho que o cuidado paliativo é, sobretudo, uma filosofia de trabalho, quase uma filosofia de vida para quem trabalha nele, né? Se transforma nisso. E, quando a gente fala em cuidar, a gente tem que ampliar o nosso olhar. É muito além da beira do leito, é muito além da pessoa que está doente, da sua família. É muito também as pessoas que cuidam, mas, sobretudo, a gente tem que cuidar da nossa comunidade, do ambiente, envolver o máximo de pessoas nessa tarefa. Cuidar do planeta, cuidar da vida, sobretudo. Bom, tenho a tarefa de convidar ao palco a Liz Bryan. Liz Bryan tem um currículo aqui extenso que eu acho que todos vocês já conhecem, um currículo formal, porque ela já esteve aqui outras vezes. Mas me permita, Liz, uma apresentação mais informal, como manda a casa, como a quase regra da casa. Eu acho que a Liz hoje é, sobretudo, uma grande amiga nossa. Acho que ela traz com ela um símbolo e toda a história do início do cuidado paliativo, que é o St. Christopher Hospice, que é a história da Cicely Saunders, idealizadora de tudo isso, e é por ela que estamos todos aqui. E eu acho que ela vem trazendo essa energia, ela vem trazendo essa vibração, ela vem trazendo essa filosofia para a gente, para compartilhar com a gente. A Liz é uma compartilhadora nesse momento, aqui, com essa comunidade do Hospital Premier. E a Liz, eu acho que é uma grande amiga hoje de todo esse movimento do cuidado paliativo que a gente tem feito aqui nessa casa e com essas pessoas que estão aqui, cada vez mais pessoas se agregando ao movimento. Seja muito bem-vinda à nossa casa e que seja também a sua casa desde sempre. Muito obrigada. Pode vir, Liz.
So, hello again. I have to confess that for this presentation, I have appealed to many of my colleagues at St. Christopher's for some slides. And I hope that despite bringing slides from different presentations, there will be some continuity. Community engagement at St. Christopher's is a current, a challenge, but a project, I think, that we are tackling or addressing with great enthusiasm and excitement, but also recognizing there are some risks involved in changing a model of care, and I do say model, it's not there's no change to the palliative care philosophy, but the model of care delivered at St. Christopher's is going through transition, and that can feel uncertain and scary for staff, and concerns around sustainable funding if you change the message to your local community and the community that we're so involved with, but also dependent on for voluntary donations. We are a charity. So I want to look at volunteering. Volunteering from the beginning has been an essential part of our culture, our community, the community of our organisation, and how we're rethinking what volunteering might look like in the future, whether that needs to be reviewed. And what do we mean by community engagement in contrast to volunteering? And I'm just going to give a very short description of Compassionate Neighbours as an example. Now I'm going to show you a film, and while that is being, because it takes a little while to line up, I just want to explain that this film is the first thing that anyone coming onto our website will see, and it's really trying to communicate what happens in the building. Now, bear in mind, St. Christopher's was originally, when Sicily opened St. Christopher's over 50 years ago, it was an inpatient unit. It was a home for the dying. But it's been transformed over the years. Now, we have less beds now than we had at the beginning. We had 56, we now have 38, but we have 1,000 patients in our community, and only a few of our patients will actually come into the hospice as an inpatient at any point in our relationship with them. So what we want people to see is actually what happens at St. Christopher's in the building. And so this film talks about that, but it doesn't actually show any images of the work that we're actually doing in people's homes. But it does show you where outpatients come, where people might come during the day. We no longer call it daycare. It really is just an open space for people to drop in. Some will be coming for prescribed interventions, whether that's rehab or counselling. But we are really encouraging it to be a place that people might come for Sunday lunch, to enjoy concerts, activities, and to just use it as a base for enjoying the gardens, etc. So just bear in mind, this is not for professionals, this is for people in our community to understand what a hospice is. So, you can see that we are attempting there to address the concerns that a lot of our patients have about, you know, a hospice being about dying, really trying to change public perspective. But I just wanted you to know a little bit about what happens at St. Christopher's. I think that's quite difficult to see. But as I've said before, I need to impress upon you that St. Christopher's and virtually all the other hospices in the UK are charitable foundations. They're hospices. And they are charities, but they're very much owned by their community. And one of the problems with this is that we don't have a uniform spread of hospice services. So hospices tend to spring up in parts of the country where communities have gathered together and decided that they're going to fundraise and build a hospice. So it means that we have to work really closely with the public health system, the NHS, but also need to recognise that there are going to be gaps in availability of specialist palliative care. And you can see the figures there, as I've mentioned before. It cost £21 million for us to stand still at St Christopher's. £21 million to offer the services we're currently offering, and we're only scratching the surface. And that we get about £6 million from through government commissioning. The rest we have to fundraise. So I want to talk about how we manage to deliver our services and how we can respond, or how we are trying to respond to the increasingly diverse but increasingly complex and challenging for our services, the needs and the preferences of our current and potential users. And if we're to use volunteers in a way that reflects their personal ambitions, how do we use the social assets that we have, the people in our community that have all sorts of interests and gifts and availabilities, how are we going to make use of those? And how do we deprofessionalize? Again, I've said this several times, I think, over the last few days, deprofessionalize palliative and end-of-life care. So when I'm talking to countries who are currently trying to build up the professional services, we're now in a position where we're saying we've almost gone too far, that actually now everybody expects, when they're dying, to have professional interventions. And is that always necessarily the case? And for countries maybe where you have unexplored assets in your communities, that maybe you should be looking at there as well as a parallel process. So this is an important document by Jake Garber and Charles Ledbetter. To allow people the deaths they want, end-of-life care must be radically transformed. So those are the sort of things that we're looking at in the UK systems. And these drivers of for change, a lot of these things have come out, I think, over the last few days. Limitations to our professional knowledge, things like social determinants being recognised, thinking about upstream interventions. By that I mean getting to people a lot earlier, before they reach crisis. Death being unfamiliar to people in our society. People don't see, in the UK, they don't see people dying as often as they would have done maybe 50 years ago. It's something that happens in another space. It happens in hospitals. Loneliness is an epidemic in our society. People actually being isolated and not speaking to another human being for days, sometimes weeks on end. Demographic changes and, as we spoke about yesterday, compassion being questioned, certainly definitions of. So where might the solutions lie? It's important to sort of set this whole narrative within the broader discussions that are happening around public health and public engagement, and to also set it in what's happening historically in global health. The Declaration of Almaty, where it was one of the first international conferences looking at primary health care, and actually already talking about communities being fully participating, looking at rather than promoting a dependency on professional services, trying to promote self-reliance and self-determination. The Ottawa Charter, which was one of the first public health charters, again looking at healthy public policy, supportive environments, community action, all the things that really are now in palliative care, extremely relevant, very pertinent, and we need to, as we develop our services or evaluate the models bear in mind that these things have already been thought about and can be resources to us, to our thinking. And more recently, the World Health Organization, again, really pointing to the importance of primary health and health service set in the community. So, new public health is participatory, not paternalistic. Easier said than done, I know, but and a lot of the culture change actually needs to happen within our professions. A focus on social justice and societal change, partnerships, working in partnership between professionals and communities, looking beyond the biomedical perspectives and lay expertise and professional expertise being respected, co-respected. Now, I think Premier is a really good example of an organisation that really is sitting within a community and making every attempt to draw in perspectives other than the biomedical. And so, you know, you have I think, my sense is this week is that you have a real will here in Sao Paulo to be experimental, to take risks. Funding is always going to be a problem, and I think often we're not very creative about how we attract funding, and maybe we've had more experience and more history in the UK society. Everybody gives to charity. Nearly everybody does some volunteering. It's part of our culture. And I think, you know, when your system is very much either private or public, actually thinking about whether incorporating a little bit more voluntary sector initiative would be a good way to go. Certainly worth exploring. Yeah, there must be some wealthy Brazilians that would love to give their money to some of your innovations, particularly footballers, I would imagine. I think the work of Alan Keller here has been mentioned, certainly Gustav mentioned it on the first day. I point out this slide, as I said, you know, I borrowed from a colleague, but I think what is really interesting about this is how small the specialist palliative care wheel is. We have to be careful not to raise people's expectations to think that specialist palliative care units are suddenly going to take on all the palliative care that's required. Many people have asked me, you know, how are we going to develop services? Well, I think we need to be really working on developing the skills and the competence and the attitudes of people working in the public service, public healthcare, and generalists, family medicine, et cetera, so that we can actually do some of that upstream thinking as well as using compassionate communities. So this, what we now call the new public health model and end-of-life care. So Keller here talks very much about compassionate communities, building partnerships between services and communities, to build on the strengths and the skills they possess rather than replacing them with professional care. I remember years back somebody telling me a rather sad story about the development of the National Health Service in a small island. It's actually the island of Malta, and which all healthcare in those days had been delivered by religious orders. And it was considered to be, so the church were basically running all the healthcare. And some bright person decided, you know, modernization would be to take the healthcare away from the church and put in publicly funded healthcare systems. What apparently that did was community that had worked very comfortably with the church because that was part of their culture, then decided that, oh, if the state are going to run this, then we can step back, let them do it. And actually it became then a really expensive exercise, which had all sorts of issues. And the point this person was making as they were telling me about it was that sometimes we have to be really careful not to alienate those people who are already delivering care in a very informal, supportive, and maybe would be able to do it in a more sustainable way with some support, some help, some sense of collaboration and partnership. And just to, I think this is quite an interesting perspective, the idea that social relationships, community building, can actually raise our mortality rates. So actually people will live longer if they're more integrated, they're encouraged and supported to be more in more effective social relationships. I mean, I think that's fascinating, isn't it? So this is the study, you won't be able to see it particularly, but it's quite clear that there are all sorts of interventions, include giving up smoking, which is probably similar. But to think that social intervention, community building, social responsibility, promoting all of those things could in fact not only help people to live longer, but to live lives that have greater quality. This is yet another study that's saying the same thing, really. I put this in because Libby Salno and Heather Richardson work at St. Christopher's. Heather Richardson is one of our CEOs. Again, looking at new public health approaches to end-of-life care. So just to say a little bit about hospices and volunteering. As I've said before, volunteering is very much part of our culture. It can be traced right back to medieval times. You can see there that they estimate that there were 500 voluntary hospitals established in England during the 12th and 13th centuries. And volunteers have been vital to hospices throughout the UK. All hospices involve volunteers to the extent that they reckoned in 2006, those volunteers were saving us £112 million. So those were tasks that volunteers were actually delivering that otherwise would have cost the hospices £112 million. Well, we wouldn't have been able to run because we wouldn't have been able to afford it. So just current volunteer stats at St. Christopher's, we have 1,240 volunteers. I think it's actually a little bit more than that. But look at the ages. We only have about 142 that are under the age of 50. We have approximately 447 over 50 and 102 over 75. I think we just celebrated the birthday of a volunteer who's in her 90s who works in our cafe. Quite a few, though, we don't have stats for. We don't know. We've never asked them how old they are. The reason I'm mentioning this is because there's some evidence that actually we are doing a service for our volunteers. Our volunteers are finding meaning, particularly those that are elderly, after retirement, in older age, where they are able to contribute to the life of the hospice and feel useful. And some are literally coming into the hospice in their wheelchairs in order to volunteer We have one in education, lady who's got motor neurone disease now, who volunteers in our library, but she's been volunteering for us for at least 10 years, and when she was fit and well. So she's gone through that diagnosis whilst working as a volunteer. But what's the difference between the traditional model of volunteering in hospice and now what we're calling community participation? So the idea really is that volunteers are recruited, interviewed, and assigned a role. They're trained to actually deliver a service within the hospice. So they're either trained as a patient-facing volunteer, or they come in to work as a bereavement counsellor, so they're trained as a volunteer bereavement counsellor. They have a role. The thing about community participation is that we're not recruiting them, we're not giving them a label, we're not saying this is what you have to do. It's very much about what do you have to give and how can we facilitate you to be in relationship with people in your community, not necessarily even our patients, but how do we encourage you to start being aware of the people in your street, in your block of flats, even within your family, and what skills would you like, what will enable you to be more useful? So it is about partnerships. It's based on a shared power base and reciprocity, which means basically both partners benefit. The person being befriended and the befriender, both. So relationships become both process and outcome, that actually the intervention is in fact building relationships, and actually that reduces social isolation. And while doing this facilitation, we begin to listen and hear what the needs of our community are, rather than assuming that we know what they are. Actually, people start telling us, really, this would be helpful. And we can enable and empower them to then achieve whatever it is they think that their community needs. We need to be clear and confident about what success might look like. So to start with, it was all very vague, but we're getting greater clarity about what are we trying to achieve? What would be a good outcome? And how to evaluate that. So we have researchers, Libby Salno is now working with us, looking at how we can evaluate. We also need to look at how this is distinct from other aspects of the work that we're doing within the hospice. So I've shown you the new model that we've on a previous occasion. So the direct care and support being a very small element, and then as we go down the pyramid, moving much more in how we can bring about societal change. Again, this is a repeat of the some of the messages earlier in the week. You know, this idea that dying is a social experience with clinical consequences, yeah, rather than a clinical event with social consequences. That is really important. We have over-medicalized the process of aging and dying. We have certainly in the UK. So I'm going to say that again. Dying is a social experience with clinical consequences rather than a clinical event with social consequences. So if it is a social experience, then why is it not set in a social context? And then we need to be told when a clinical intervention is needed. We need to think about end of life in a much wider context. So not dying, but actually, in fact, that last phase of life, we're beginning to use that expression. So that might be, I mean, I think I'm entering into the last phase of my life, thinking about retirement. And you know, just that sort of having an open and pragmatic and a realistic conversation with myself and the people around me about how I want to spend the last years of my life. But we also need to recognize, you know, it's a universal experience, but some people are going to find it hugely challenging in our society. So I know, again, people have said to me this week, well, the problem in Brazil is, and it's always followed with, people don't like talking about dying. People don't like talking about dying anywhere. And so it's finding ways together to open up conversations. So Compassionate Neighbours is just one of those examples where we encourage people who are interested in doing something in their community to come and do a very informal training, which is really about conversations and raising their awareness about the sort of people in their community that might benefit from befriending. And then linking, when appropriate, with people we know of in the community that are suffering social isolation. And this is just a lovely example. Anna is the lady on the right, and Judy is the lady on the left. They are living fairly close to each other. They have shared interests. But what's really interesting is you have loneliness and bereavement motivating Judy, and health issues motivating Anna. And this has become a friendship rather than a volunteer relationship. So, just to finish, my questions to you would be, what skills and experiences can you draw from the people who want to give their time? What do you think might motivate older people to volunteer because they will also benefit from the experience? And can volunteering opportunities be flexible to allow older people to continue to volunteer when their health or circumstances change? What other links do you have with groups or residents in the area outside of clinical colleagues? And where are the gaps? Who could help you connect? Thank you.